The first dose did not do much. Perhaps the man felt a little lethargic, maybe a little tired and out of sorts. By the second dose, he felt as though he were suffering from a cold. He didn't feel well, but he had also felt worse. He likely felt the need to take it easy that day, take a nap, get some rest. The third dose made him very ill. He was dehydrated, but his caretakers might have thought it due to how much diarrhea and vomiting he had done. Yet no matter how much he drank, he was always thirsty. He might have thought the cold was instead the flu, until his insides began to burn. No prior illness had ever felt so excruciating. His loved ones likely tried to give him a mixture of vinegar and lemon to soothe his pains, but the agony only worsened, so they instead called for a priest, asked him to repent any sins. Because the fourth dose killed. I'm Elise, and this is Old Blood, the historical true crime podcast. Sherlock Holmes said it. Game of Thrones said it, poison's a woman's weapon, men kill with steel. Even without the steel bit, the implication behind the saying that poison is a woman's weapon is not a nice one. Because beating someone to death or stabbing or shooting someone is a more manly way to murder, apparently. The implication being that if a man wants to kill you, he will do it while you watch him. He won't hide. And he isn't afraid of a little mess. Now, men kill a lot more often than women, as in about 90% of murders are committed by men. But of the 10% of female murderers, poison is sixth on the list of weapons they use. It's not as though female murderers are using poison left and right, and since there are so many more male murderers than females, most poisoners are men. But when comparing male to female murderers, women actually do favor poison more often than men. There are reasons for that, beyond the sexist ones usually listed. Historically speaking, women were usually the ones to prepare food, administer medicines, and care for the sick, so women had more opportunities to poison than men did. And then there is the fact that women are generally smaller than men and less strong. So, before the advent of guns, women didn't like the odds of trying to beat or stab a man to death when he's stronger than her. And if you administer poison the right way, it's actually a smarter way to kill with less mess and less evidence, particularly if you lived during an era when there was no way to test for poisons postmortem. If a woman measured out the dosages of poison accurately and had good timing, one might never even know that a man was even murdered, as it would just appear as though he had died of some sort of illness or disease. Daniel Kevles, who wrote a book on the history of poison, called it the Great Equalizer, for how it allowed women to overcome the fact that they were weaker than men, both physically and on the social ladder. And when you think of famous poisoners, you might envision Catherine de' Medici of Florence, later Queen of France, who tested the efficacy of her poisons on the poor and sick. You might also think of Lucrezia Borgia, daughter of Pope Alexander VI, who allegedly helped her brother Cesare murder their family's enemies through the use of a hollowed-out ring that she filled with the famous Borgia poison called La Cantarella, said to be a mixture of arsenic and toxins from a poisonous beetle. Historians say that there's no evidence Lucrezia actually poisoned anyone, by the way. But the fact remains that beyond being seen as a woman's weapon is also quite often thought of as an Italian phenomenon. Lucrezia's father, the Pope, likely died from poisoning. Venice's governing body during the 16th century, called the Council of Ten, was rumored to have used poison to eliminate their competitors, And in Florence, city council records detail incidents of poisoning that include even the payments, prices, and contracts between the sellers of the poison and their customers. Even one of the most famous Italians, Leonardo da Vinci, was also known to have experimented with poisons, and after Queen Christina of Sweden abdicated her throne, she resided in Rome where alchemy flourished under her patronage. Italy became so crazed with the art of poisoning that training schools popped up in Venice, Florence, and Rome. It seemed as though all of 17th century Europe knew that if you wanted poisons, or if you wanted to become skilled in the art of poisoning, you went to Italy. But poisoning was also a product of the times. Historian Mike Dash quoted a French duke who lived in the 17th century who said, quote, "It seems that there are, at certain moments, crimes which become the fashion, like clothes. Poisoning was à la mode at the time." End quote. But beyond that fascination was a very real fear that quickly transformed into a panic that seized the city of Rome. Suddenly, it seemed as though there were far more young widows that walked the streets. There were far too many husbands who had fallen ill and died. Then the Pope, Alexander VII, was notified that many of these young widows made their way into confessionals to confess their sins of murdering their abusive husbands. Roman authorities issued a warning to the public in the 1650s, as the citizens began to panic for fear of a new, slow-acting poison that was almost impossible to detect. Some of the many symptoms were vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration, and a burning sensation in the intestines. If you Google Acqua Tofana, you will quickly be directed to a woman named Giulia Tofana. The search results will tell you that Tofana was a beautiful woman who was born in the early 17th century in Sicily. Giulia grew up watching apothecaries brew their elixirs and such, and learned how to create them on her own. In her adulthood, she fled to Rome with her daughter, Girolama Spara, where they began creating and distributing a poison called Acqua Tofana, named after Giulia, or perhaps her mother, Teofania. Of course, the authorities and men who wrote about her wanted to portray her as an old hag, but Tofana and Spara were actually seen as heroes to the women of Rome because their poisons helped them escape the abusive and miserable conditions they lived in. Poisons had existed for thousands upon thousands of years, but none of them compared to the efficacy and inconspicuousness of Acqua Tofana. Tofana and later Spara, who took up her mother's business, sold her project through word of mouth. She was very selective about her clients because she needed to trust that they would not turn her in to the authorities. But once she accepted a client, she would create the potion by using a carefully blended mixture of arsenic, lead, and belladonna. The arsenic she acquired through contact of a priest, Father Girolamo, whose brother was an apothecary and could use his position in society to shield Tofana and her crew from the authorities. She then put the poison into a decorative bottle embellished with the image of Saint Nicholas, which normally was filled with oil taken from the tomb of the dead saint and used as a healing ointment for acne and other sorts of facial blemishes. The women who purchased the poisons left these bottles hiding out in the open among their other bottles of perfumes and cosmetics. Tofana provided these women with a bit of training in addition to the poisons, and taught them how to calculate when and to what degree the poison would take effect. The poison promised death in 4 to 6 drops, with the first 2 drops making their victims mildly ill, and then severely ill by the 3rd and 4th. Tofana instructed them how to space out the doses so as to make sure death would occur after a specific period of time. Other poisons made their victims deathly ill shortly after ingesting them, so the authorities would investigate the victims' last meals and then arrest anyone seen tinkering with them. But Acqua Tofana could kill someone days, weeks, even months afterwards, making the victim's prolonged illness appear as though it were natural and allowing the murderer to avoid blame. Tofana told the widows-to-be to demand a post-mortem examination to further shed themselves of any suspicion, knowing that no one could detect Aqua Tofana. The women of Rome revered Tofana, Spara, and their associates for helping them to escape the men that abused them. Women owned nothing. The Catholic Church did not allow divorce, and annulment was almost impossible. Even if a woman was able to separate from her husband, her reputation would be destroyed. They could hardly even escape to join a convent, for that, too, had the reputation of being the destination of former prostitutes. Wives had no power over their own lives, no escape save death. So women banded together. They supported each other, suggested remedies for their problems, passed on advice, and, if they trusted each other, recommended them to Giulia Tofana. Tofana did ask for payment in exchange for her services, but she was also known to have helped a select few who either were too poor to afford the payment or whose story enraged her enough to want to help. For years, the abusive husbands of Rome dropped dead and the streets filled with widows. And all of this did eventually lead to suspicion among the authorities, yet they had no evidence of any wrongdoing. That is, until a customer who purchased Aqua Tofana chickened out of poisoning her husband's bowl of soup at the last moment. She abruptly stopped him from beginning his meal, which raised suspicion. After pulling the truth out of his wife, he marched her to the police to confess. The police, in turn, set up a sting and sent a woman undercover to purchase some poison from Spara. After Spara sold it to her, the police arrested her and tested the poison on some stray dogs to be sure it was actually poison. Unfortunately, it was. After days of torture, Tofana admitted that she and her associates had murdered over 600 men since arriving in Rome 4 years earlier. Not long after, Roman authorities hanged Tofana, Spiro, and 4 other associates from the gallows in the Campo dei Fiori, one of Rome's main squares. Aqua Tofana disappeared for the most part, though the fear of it did not. On his deathbed, Mozart was panic-stricken that someone had given him Aqua Tofana and calculated the moment of his death. To this day, no one knows its exact ingredients, nor how to create anything like this infamous slow-acting poison. Well, that's probably because Aqua Tofana never existed, and neither did Giulia Tofana. Let's consider this a lesson in sources and fact-checking. Remember all those teachers who insisted that Wikipedia was not a legitimate source of information? And how you shouldn't trust everything you read on the internet? Well, they were right. Because when you Google Aqua Tofana or Giulia Tofana, you will get some version of the story that I just told you. And keep digging, one page in, 2, 3, 4, they will all tell you a version of this story, though perhaps with some details changed. Maybe they end the story with Giulia seeking refuge in a church, but then the police pulling her out of there anyway, killing her, and then throwing her back over the church walls after the priest demanded her return. Or maybe you get the version where she lived her life out in a convent, or maybe in a jail cell well into the 1700s where curious folk went to visit her and ask questions. Or because Giulia supposedly admitted to poisoning 600 men, others write about how she was one of the most prolific serial killers in history. Never mind that she was also supposedly tortured until she said this. You might get the version of Giulia dying soon after getting to Rome and Spara becoming the ringleader of the poisoners. Or maybe you come across some article on Medium or one of those pop culture websites that tried to draw you in with a clickbaity title saying something along the lines of, "Come meet the woman who killed 600 men with her makeup." All of these are wrong. Some might have little bits of truth scattered throughout, but yeah, they all cite Wikipedia as their source, and they're all wrong. The two sources I found that are the closest to the truth are a 2015 article by historian Mike Dash and a book published almost a year ago by Craig Monson. And there weren't really any primary sources for me to look at. There were books written in the 1800s about the scandal, but that's nowhere near the 1650s timeframe when the poisonings took place, and also, they're in Italian. There could be others that I'm missing, but from what I've read, Mike Dash was one of the first to write about the inconsistencies between the myth of Giulia Toffana and what we actually have records of. For this, he used two sources that he thought more reliable than the rest: Alessandro Adamolo and Salvatore Salamine Marino, both of whom lived in the late 19th century. Adamolo used Italian archives for his account, and Marino used a notary who was a contemporary of the poisoners. And from these sources, Dash came to the conclusion that the Giulia who lived in prison until the 1700s probably was not the real Giulia. The real Giulia, or the real poisoner, likely lived in the early to mid-1600s. She probably did die soon after moving to Rome, and probably did have a woman named Girolama Sparo take over after her with the other four female accomplices, though he never states that Sparo was Giulia's daughter. Moreover, Dash doesn't see any concrete evidence that Acqua Toffana, as the myth describes it, ever existed. He wondered if perhaps Acqua Toffana was simply arsenic, and that, quote, "coincidence and wishful thinking," end quote, made it into the feared poison it became. Luck and perhaps the placebo effect gave Acqua Toffana its reputation, and once it had that, Dash says, quote, "a quick-thinking huckster could always conjure reasons why a spell or potion had failed to work," end quote. And he made an even better argument by talking about how it was hard to believe that these women could have produced a poison that we don't know of today with all of our scientific knowledge and high-tech equipment. Dash argued that Acqua Toffana really was just the product of panic. Women killing their abusive husbands and getting away with it was a challenge to the natural order, Dash says, where, quote, "men ruled as petty tyrants over their own families," end quote. What could be more terrifying to an abusive husband than the knowledge that your death could have already been decided? That in 1 week you might be dying in the most excruciating way possible? Killed by the one you trusted to feed you your meals, and then second-guessing whether the remedies she gives you really are remedies, and not more poison. Fear that a woman might kill you and no one would ever know. Fear that women just might be more powerful than you gave them credit for. In 2020, author Craig Monson published his book, The Black Widows of the Eternal City: The True Story of Rome's Most Infamous Poisoners. Monson came across like the holy grail of historical documents several years earlier, almost 1,500 pages of first-hand information regarding the 1659 poisoning trials in Rome. I'm talking about the actual papers that some dude took with him around Rome as he talked to the poisoners and wrote down what they were saying as they were saying it, including testimony signed by the poisoners themselves. I'm totally geeking out over this. It doesn't get any more primary sourcey than this. It's like every historian's dream come true. Monson explained that these documents had actually been hidden away by the Pope in Rome's Castel Sant'Angelo, supposedly for fear that otherwise someone would get the recipe of the poison and start the panic all over again. The documents resurfaced briefly in the late 19th century, and then went missing again until Monson magically found it in his hands when visiting Rome's state archives. Apparently, the call number was hidden, and no one ever really tried hard enough to find it until Monson did. So, for over 350 years, people simply reprinted gossip and hearsay. Some might have known what the truth was, but preferred the sensationalized stories that sold. And now we have a hodgepodge of stories that have picked through various different accounts, taking what they thought interesting and leaving what they didn't, to the point where even those who really tried to get it right had to select from what probably didn't happen and what could have happened. Until Monson and his translation of the Holy Grail, that is. According to Monson, there was no Julia. None of the real poisoners ever uttered the words Aqua Tofana, and the undercover sting to capture them never occurred. No one's dead body was ever thrown over a churchyard wall, in this event at least, and the real Julia and Sparra were not biological mother and daughter. Girolama Sparra was actually Gironima Spana. The real Julia Tofana was named Julia Mangiardi. And now, I present to you the real story of the Italian poison panic of 1659. Anna Maria Caterina Aldobrandini hailed from one of Rome's most powerful and noble families, but that did not protect her from abuse. In fact, it almost ensured it, for generally, the more powerful the family, the more political the marriage, and the less care given to the women involved. But that didn't mean Maria had to make it easy on them. She was difficult to manage, Monson said, and quotes the Pope's biographer who said, Maria was, quote, notoriously difficult to control, both because of the supremacy of her birth and no less because of the weakness of her sex, end quote. But regardless of her wishes, the Aldobrandini family married Maria off at the age of 13. She married the Duke of Ceri, Francesco Cesi, who was about 43 years old and belonged to another of Rome's richest and most powerful families. His father had been a friend of Galileo, and Francesco himself was a nephew to the future pope. The duke's marriage to Maria was his second, and he hoped that marrying a woman so young would ensure himself an heir. Maria was a beauty, despite some smallpox scars, and became the object of many men's attention, including Francesco Maria Santinelli, a low-ranking member of the nobility, poet, alchemist, and known womanizer. Let's just call it how it is and say he was most definitely a fuckboy. Now, we don't know whether or not Maria knew of his reputation or simply did not care, but it is clear that she fell deeply in love with him regardless. By the time Maria was 22, her husband was well into his 50s. They were married for almost a decade, and she was sick of him and constantly complained that he was so weak. But more than that, she was in love and didn't want to waste her life away with someone she hadn't chosen for herself. She spoke to a priest, Father Girolamo, who spoke to Maria about these women who created poisons. He conferred with Giovanna de Grandis, who worked with Spana, both agreeing that she should use a different type of poison than what Spana usually sold, because the usual one made their victims start violently vomiting and made it pretty obvious that they were poisoned. De Grandis worried him that he and Maria had better be careful, quote, because these great lords' bellies must be cut open once they're dead. They could figure something out, end quote. Father worked with Gironima Spana, Giovanna De Grandis, and her other three associates to produce a more inconspicuous poison, which they poured into a small glass bottle and sealed with wax and paper. Maria was having trouble figuring out how to get the Duke to consume the poison, because her high status meant that she herself would never prepare her husband's meals, and if she tried to add something to it, someone would definitely notice. De Grandis said the same thing, telling Father Girolamo how, quote, it would be difficult to give it to the Duke because of his servers at table. What these sorts of people eat passes through the hands of cooks, carvers, and other servants, end quote. Eventually, Maria settled on asking her housekeeper, a trusted confidant, to sneak the poison into her husband's meal. A few days later, de Grandis heard that the Duke of Cherry had died, and so she assumed that Maria's housekeeper was successful in giving him the poison. De Grandis wanted to see for herself, so she visited the church where the Duke lay dead in his open coffin. Others assumed that perhaps Maria's lover, Santinelli, was behind it, or perhaps the Duke contracted the plague which had been going around the city at the time, despite the fact that he didn't really have any of the plague's usual symptoms. Queen Christina of Sweden was friends with Santinelli, bonded by their mutual love of alchemy, and so she used her influence to shield him from the accusations that he murdered the Duke. The Aldobrandinis were horrified that Maria was interested in him because he was so far below her on the social ladder that some commented on how he was lowly enough to be Maria's servant. Her family, willing to do anything to keep them apart, promptly whisked her away and imprisoned her in a convent. Other women had more serious reasons for going to Spana. Caterina Nucci poisoned her first husband because he was abusive. Anna Maria Conti poisoned her Parisian second husband for abusing her. Lucia Bettona targeted her brother, who was also abusive. One wife's husband beat his stepsons so badly that she feared the day when he would kill them. Another woman said, quote, "I didn't know how to survive because my husband just hung about and did absolutely nothing so that I was reduced to the worst possible state," end quote. A sentiment that Monson said about half a dozen other wives shared. And unlike today when divorce and good-paying jobs for women are possible, these wives depended upon their husbands to keep them and their families alive and fed. Spana herself experienced the stress of having a husband who was irresponsible with money and who was unfaithful to her on top of it. Spana's stepmother, Giulia Mangiardi, aka Tofana, created and trafficked the poison and apparently passed the profession down to Spana after Giulia died in 1651. Dash says that Spana was widowed by a Florentine member of the aristocracy, though I'm not sure if Monson's sources would back this up, but Dash says that because of Spana's link to the aristocracy, she had contacts with the noblewomen of Rome that she used to peddle her poisons, leaving the other women in the poison ring to service the commoners. The frequency of suspicious deaths ramped up in 1655 and plateaued in 1658. By January of 1659, Inspector Stefano Brocchi interrogated the wives of the husbands who died and led him to the five ringleaders. Brocchi identified de Grandis as another major figure in the poisonings and arrested her and another accomplice at the end of January after finding de Grandis in possession of poison. De Grandis seems to have immediately confessed to everything, leading to Spana's arrest the following day. Spana, however, went to the gallows months later, still refusing to confess. Monson says that Spana outlasted months of interrogations and witnessing three of her accomplices tortured in front of her, a tactic that the inspector favored. Apparently, even after de Grandis began cooperating, she was still tortured before two sisters who had both murdered their husbands and helped to sell the poison. Inspector Brocchi was ready to lose his mind with Spana, who, no matter what he did, refused to give him a confession. As many witnesses as he had, and as much evidence as he had collected, he still had no evidence that the five women who led this poison ring had ever actually murdered anyone. They had created and sold the poison, but never used it themselves. And in a nod to what would happen to Raya and Sakina of Episode 5, these women were the only ones executed while the others lived to face other various punishments. The authorities in Rome never pretended to practice equality in meting out justice. The inspector offered a handful of women immunity in exchange for information, starting with Marta Buzzicoli, who confessed to selling poison given to her by de Grandis. The inspector was under strict orders to only go after the commoners. Apparently, the Pope ordered the governor of Rome to largely ignore the women of rank who murdered their husbands including Maria Aldobrandini. Many guilty women without titles of nobility were tortured in an effort to extract confessions from others, and if they were not one of the five who were executed, they likely faced life in prison for their involvement in the murders. Several women were humiliated and whipped as they walked through the streets of Rome before being exiled. Yet women of rank were instead sent to convents or allowed to flee Italy, or, in the case of Maria, faced no repercussions at all. In fact, according to Dash, Pope Alexander VII ordered that Maria's name be kept out of the trial entirely because he was concerned about the Aldobrandini family reputation. In the newly rediscovered documents, Monson noted that Inspector Brocchi left her name out of all interrogations, though the accused brought her name up on their own when confessing what they knew. In one of the few similarities between what I like to call the wiki versions and the original trial records, Gionema Spana, Giovanna de Grandis, and the other three main conspirators were eventually hanged in the Campo dei Fiori. Despite the lack of evidence, they personally never poisoned anyone, and despite the fact that they had evidence of many others who were personally guilty and let them live. After her death, Spana's home was sold to junk dealers, according to Monson, and when clearing out the home, one of the men noticed some funny-looking rocks, and knowing who the home once belonged to, he took the rock to an apothecary who confirmed that it was antimony, a poisonous metallic element. Someone also discovered a bottle buried underneath Spana's old garden, which they tested on a dog to see whether or not it was poison. They got their confirmation 6 days later when the dog died. And don't even ask me how many poor animals died during the course of these investigations. I don't even want to think about it. As for Maria Aldobrandini, her family kept her confined in the convent of San Silvestro to keep her from marrying Santinelli. Somehow, she managed to convince the nuns to help her escape from the convent, and she attempted to make her way back to her lover. Unfortunately, Maria was recaptured, and the Pope ordered her into Castel Sant'Angelo. In 1658, Santinelli was exiled to Vienna, so the Pope freed her and placed her under the care of her mother and stepfather. They took Maria as far south in Italy as they could, in the toe of Italy's boot. Yet Maria still managed to outwit her captors and convince someone to obtain a marriage to Santinelli on her behalf. Furious, the Pope promptly annulled it. Maria tried to escape on 4 different occasions. In 1667, she was finally successful. She made her way to Santinelli, to whom she spent the next 30 years, happily married and under the protection of Isabella Clara, Archduchess of Austria, who was also rumored to have poisoned her husband, the promiscuous and unfaithful Duke of Mantua. It's hard to know who the real victims are in this case, since we don't have all the details. And Monson provides lists of those who died and those who were accused of murder, even specifically noting the men who were abusive. But it's not clear whether the other men who were killed were also abusive. Of course, we would define abuse quite differently today than back then, and it's entirely possible some of these women were emotionally or mentally abused by their husbands, but did not identify their experiences as abuse, and as such were not recorded. Even Maria's situation is a little cloudy because we know she was motivated by her affair with Santinelli, but we don't know all that much about her marriage to the Duke. Though, if you ask me, marrying a 13-year-old so that she can give you an heir is absolutely abuse. I do wonder, though, about how many people were poisoned without being guilty of any sort of abuse. How many were killed for entirely selfish purposes? Of course, there were plenty of men throughout the centuries who wrote accounts of the poisonings and were sympathetic to the men who were poisoned. They loved to portray the men as hag-ridden, to use Monson's term, as in burdened by wicked, nagging wives who eventually killed them in cold blood. The Roman authorities who prosecuted Spana and her gang seem to have shared this view, and saw the marital abuse as a motive for murder, but not a justification. Monson noted the hypocrisy of male abuse not being a justification for murder in 17th century Rome, even though a wife cheating on her husband was justification for him to murder her. To even the scales just slightly, Monson's book focused on showing the perspectives of, quote, the abused wife, her strength to fight back, her brief success, and her ultimate defeat by powerful men and a society that offered precious little recourse. And perhaps this is the reason for panic over these poisons, more so than just the shock value of uncovering a poison ring. Perhaps the patriarchal Italian authorities panicked over the thought that there actually were repercussions for their actions. Panic over the realization that women could and would fight back. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Old Blood. If you did, please give us a rating and spread the word. For information about our sources, please see the show notes. For extra information and images related to our episodes, please follow us on Instagram at Old Blood Podcast or go to oldbloodpodcast.com. Music credits to Shane Ivers at silvermansound.com.